I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
This episode is brought to you by Paramount Plus. Get in, loser! Mean Girls is now streaming on Paramount Plus. Join Katie Heron as she meets the plastics and Tina Fey's new twist on the modern classic. Get ready for more of the rumors, backstabbing, and jokes you loved from the original movie with some fetch surprises. Rated PG-13. Wear pink and head to ParamountPlus.com to try it free.
What's going on, everybody? Hope you are having a wonderful week so far. Before we start the podcast, I would love it if you subscribe, share, tell your mates about this podcast. We're getting through some episodes. It's been going for a long time, so I really appreciate all of you that have like stayed from the beginning, and any new people that are involved and enjoy it and share it on the socials. Really means the world to me, so thank you very much for that. This episode I'm really excited about. Disco Donny, one of the biggest electronic music promoters in America. Him and his company promote over 1,000 shows a year, which is crazy to even think about. Some of the biggest festivals in America. He has created scenes in cities and states that you would never even imagine would have electronic music even be in that city or state. So I really, really respect what he's done for the scene in America, and is one of the reasons why there is a scene in America. He has been doing this for years, since the 90s, and has some amazing stories. So I thought it would be amazing for you all to learn about some history of American rave scene, and also learn about the ups and downs of his career. And there's some really interesting bits from being arrested and having a federal case on him, throwing huge parties and raves, losing everything. It's a really interesting conversation. I really, really enjoyed this one. So without further ado, Disco Donny. Donny, how are you, man?
Good, man. How's it going?
Yeah, really good. Really good. Thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate taking some time out.
Means
a lot, man. Where in the world are you?
I live in Puerto Rico, so I'm home. Nice. Right now.
How long you been living there?
I've been here 13 years, so it's definitely been life changing. So it's really great here. So
what made you move out?
I've enjoyed it. I married a Puerto Rican.
Makes sense.
Don't do that. Yeah. But living here is nice.
Yeah, I've never been. I've never been.
I'm still married to her, so probably she won't see this. Hopefully not. So
it's fine.
It's okay.
We won't tell her. We'll cut it out.
Yeah, right.
Do you prefer living over there than the States? Obviously, it is kind of part of the States, but
it's different for sure.
Yeah.
But you know, it's been a great place to raise a family, and I could have. You know, if I would have moved to LA or New York or something, there would have been a lot more business opportunities, but I've done well for myself here. And I think my life, the quality of life has been a lot better.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? Because there does come a point where it's like, well, how much do you actually need to do in your life? When's the limit? Right. When's the like the end of the mountain where you're like, yeah, I've actually done enough. Do you think that's given you the chance to kind of evaluate that?
A little bit. I mean, it's more about there's meetings going on all the time and different opportunities. And so, and artists coming through town. I mean, I just don't even, not a lot of people come through here. So I don't get to see a lot of artists, maybe just at the festivals and stuff.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit different. So yeah, I mean, have I thought about it? Yes. I mean, have I had regrets? Not really. My biggest regret was that I was raised in New Orleans and I never thought I would leave there. And every time I go back there, I'm just like, still enamored with the city. Basically, that's the only thing I really miss would be, living in New Orleans and that lifestyle. But it's been great here and I've made a lot of good friends and it's been great for the kids and it's been great for my wife has her whole family here. So it's been great for her.
Makes sense. Do you go back to New Orleans often?
My oldest son is in college there and my mom still lives there.
Yeah.
I'm actually going back next week for his graduation, it's pretty amazing. So go to a few Saints games every year and I still do shows there, so definitely try to make it back as often as possible.
I've only ever been to that city once. In fact, you know Max Braun. I was at his wedding just before the pandemic.
I heard about that.
Yeah, it was crazy. But it's an amazing city, man. It's like there's something super special about that city. And I'm not too sure what it is. I think it's the history, but it's kind of so many cultures all coming together as one. And it's super
for sure.
Special. Super special. I want to go fully back to where it started for you. I think there's a lot of people that know who you are and what you do nowadays and kind of what you represent now. But I kind of want people to understand where it all started from childhood to now. So I kind of want to go back to New Orleans, growing up in New Orleans and your childhood and how it all started.
From my childhood? What grade should I start in? I was born and raised in New Orleans. My mom threw my dad out of the house when I was about 8. And he basically was gone. I didn't see him for about a year. And when he turned up, he was a very successful lawyer. But he had a lot of issues and stuff. We were basically running around town all the time, chasing him at different bars a lot of womanizing and he had a lot of stuff going on besides the law practice. So my mom made the tough decision of, kicking him out of the house. He disappeared for about a year. And when he turned back up, he was he had given up his law practice and he had become a DJ named Disco Jim.
Okay.
This is in the 70s. So. This is when it was like, it was popping.
Yeah. And then I guess from then on, is that how you started to listen to music? Through your dad, or was it like New Orleans is like so rich in music generally?
Yeah, no, my mom used to take me to Jazz Fest, and every year, and so it was definitely always ingrained in me, and I started reunited with my dad and started going to the, I would go to the club with him and you know, whenever he had his weekend or whatever. So I would stay, sleep in the office, go through the, through all the vinyl. And so I guess that was my indoctrination on both ends into the music. I was also, I was a singer in a band in grade school. And it was never, it wasn't because I could sing. It was basically because I was the only one that had the confidence to get in front of people with a, and on a stage and with a microphone in my hand. I mean, unfortunately, I wasn't a good singer.
Yeah.
Or any, I wasn't even a serviceable singer, but I did have enough confidence that, you know, that I can get on the stage and be a front man.
I love that so much. I love that. Did your dad own a club?
No, he was the DJ, and he did all these like extravagant skits and yeah, different, you know, to different songs. And they had they basically, one night he did this like urban cowboy theme, and like he had everybody sign all these legal waivers so they could ride like the bucking bronco. And it was under this big giant like sheet, and so all these people were waiting in line to, you know, ride the bronco. And it turns out he had just rented like a one of those little ponies that they have in front of the grocery store, you know, just put a quarter in. So, you know, he was doing his own thing. I mean, he was happy.
Yeah.
He didn't want to, obviously he didn't want to be a lawyer. So he ended up moving up to manager of the club, but he was still Disco Jim.
Disco Jim.
To everyone.
I take it that's where you got the Disco Donnie from, right?
I think so. Yeah. When I first started going to parties, and you know, I basically was wearing like his old clothes, and he had a lot of stuff that said Disco on them.
Okay.
And so at first people were calling me Disco, somehow it morphed into to Disco Donnie. So it was definitely, I didn't give myself the moniker, but yeah, I could see why, I embraced it.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. It's wild how things like that happen, but I guess what was the club that your dad was at? Was it called Catnip or something like that?
No, it was like Scratches. It was like a pool
hall.
It had like a lot of pool tables. Amazing. And a lot of video games. I just remember, like, you know, cause I would play the video games all the time.
Yeah.
Cause we had the keys. So, yeah, I just remember as a kid just living in that place.
Yeah.
So somehow my mom, single mom, raised me, basically I ended up going to LSU for college.
Yep.
And I was studying accounting, and I was engaged to be married to my longtime, wow, my high school girlfriend.
Wow.
Who was like valedictorian of her school, like president of her school, my Mrs. Perfect, right? And
how did that happen?
There was I didn't matter. I think I felt I was less than perfect, let's put it that way. And when we came back to New Orleans, and we were about a year from getting married, I was having to be waiting tables on weekends. I was working at my mom's CPA firm during the week because I was going to take that over. And then I was waiting tables during the weekends just to make some real money for the wedding. and some other waiters like, hey, you want to go to a party? And I'm like, yeah, sure, whatever, I'll go check it out. And so I went to my first, I guess, rave, and I was just, when I walked through those doors, I was just blown away. And I kind of like, you know, when I had moved from school into New Orleans, I felt like I was missing something. And when I walked through those doors, I also felt like I had found it. So it was definitely, a life-changing experience for me, because I was like, wow, you know, why didn't I know about this? And, the second thing was I was upset that I didn't know, found out about this earlier. And then also I was like, it was a really, eccentric mix of people, all different types of people, right? That normally you wouldn't see, at the same party together. And it was like, I just found what I was like, it just filled that void that I was looking for. And so from that moment on, I was like, well, this is amazing, but you guys are terrible. There wasn't really no way. It was like 100 people there. I'm like, you guys are terrible at you know, promoting. I have more friends than this. From that moment on, I just kind of started helping out promoting, just on the side. I would just grab the flyers from the table and I started promoting the shows and bringing in more people.
What year are we talking?
This is like 93. I think when I first got back from school, maybe the end of 93. And then basically, yeah, people started noticing that I was out there, you know, I was going out every night now promoting these shows. I was going to wherever people were. Like, I had a whole crew already that I was hanging out with. My fiance was not happy. basically people, somebody offered to hire. I was just doing it for fun.
Yeah.
I was just doing it because I had it like, this was just it was a hobby. I was shopping at thrift stores every day. I was, you know, I really bought into I was going to the record stores. I really bought into the culture right away, like a hook, line, and sinker. Mm. And I just started promoting. Somebody offered to hire me, and I said, "No, I don't want any money. No, I don't want any money." And they just insisted. They insisted, and the guy, like at the end of the night, he got like 600 people, and this was like a huge improvement over the numbers that they had been getting. Mm. And you know, they were just ecstatic. And the guy was like, "Oh, you know, let me give you your payment." And he gave me like two hits of ecstasy. And he was like the drug dealer too. So it was probably, he gave me like $20, right? I was like, oh, it was like a big fuck you. I was like, I didn't want any money. And now you're, you know, telling me, you know, give me $100 or something.
Yeah.
Or, you know, so that was kind of when my first like realization about on the business side, right? So like, I never try to put myself in that position again. Now everybody's, all the established promoters are asking me to help them. And so I was like, yeah, I'll help you, but you know, I want half the door.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where I was like, and it still was a game for me, right? I still had my whole other life that I was about to embark on. Mm. And but I just wasn't going to put myself in a position again where just left it arbitrary that somebody could just give me $20.
Totally, totally. What was the music like then in New Orleans?
It was really, I mean, it's really hard to say because, you know, this is pre-internet. Yeah. This is, so there was no real, like, you couldn't really put things in buckets like you can today. Mm. Like, okay, this is like dubstep, or this is drum and bass, yeah, or this is house. You know, it was kind of all over the place. When I listened to the songs that, that a lot of people played, I mean, it was like a lot of, I guess you would call breakbeats.
Yeah.
Definitely like some techno influences. But yeah, I mean, you know, you would hear Omni Trio and Joey Beltram and so there was like, you know, but it was all over, but we didn't even know what it, like, you have to understand, if you weren't a DJ, like, there was no way to get the information. Like, it was like, oh, I like the song, but I never knew who actually made the song. You know, the only way for us to really get information, like, we would go to Tower Records and they had you know, maybe they had some CDs there. And like they had like a rave section, and I mean, you could see what who made the tracks and who this DJ that made the mix and stuff. But and then some, you know, we were getting some magazines were kind of coming in at the record stores and stuff. So, you know, you could get information there. But I mean, it was really in the early 90s. I mean, there was no track IDs. Let's put it that way.
I love that though, because I was watching the Rise documentary the other night, and the soundtrack to the Rise documentary is absolutely amazing. Like,
it's,
dude, it's unbelievable. And
Josh Wink did that.
Josh did it. And
yeah,
I was like, this is like a really interesting concept, because you don't have that nowadays where you go to a show and it's like a bunch of everything. But it really was back then, and DJing and putting on shows was not necessarily like a genre thing. It was like, you're just going to party and be part of it.
Yeah, that's what we didn't know. We didn't know. We just liked the music. I mean, there was a lot of Josh Wink at the parties. I should have thrown that in there for sure.
But it was also a really interesting time for America musically in the electronic scene, with like Chicago, with New York, with Detroit. Like, you had some insane music being made in the country then, and it was just like a hodgepodge of everything. And no one knowing anything, because it's a brand new thing.
Right. It was definitely like we were just happy with getting something. Right. Yeah. So we didn't know anything. Right. So, so it was kind of like there was no tribes or anybody breaking off into separate groups or different rooms or something like that. It was like everybody was there, you know, listening to the same music and enjoying it. And I mean, the DJ would be all over the place, right? He wasn't playing like one sound. Yeah. Right? So it was definitely it was good times.
There's something so amazing about that though, that we just don't get nowadays to a certain extent, that I think it's so easy nowadays to put everyone in a box and kind of package it in a nice commercial way and make money out of it. But I think there's something so organic about that initial naivety of the music industry or in the rave scene.
Yeah, no, I mean, I get why people have separated into their own little, you know, silos. I totally understand, but back then, like, it just didn't matter. And you know, I really miss those days.
Yeah.
That's why as a promoter now, when people ask me, like, I do have my own personal preferences on what music style I like, but, you know, that's not my, you know, I've never been one to, if I would have just done artists that, if the sound that I mostly enjoy, then I would have been out of business a long time ago. I wouldn't have made it to the house revolution, right? Yeah. So I would have been, yeah. So, you know, but that's not my job. My job is to make everybody happy, not just one subsection of people. So, you know, I actually, you know, it's like this the bullshit promoter answer, right? But I have to enjoy it all, and I actually do. So. Mm.
When was that realization for you though? Because I think there comes a point when you're in a career, or when you decide to embark into this career, that you have to do that and you have to please everybody else, and this isn't a egotistical thing where you can just please yourself?
Well, as things, well, I mean, I think it was more about like, it was better as a promoter. I never really thought about it until later, but you know, it was good for me when, like, when in the 90s that, you know, all of a sudden like drum and bass, you know, exploded.
Yeah.
And it was good. You know, I actually enjoyed it. So, but it also, now I have more, you know, I have more, it expanded the options of artists that I could book. Right. Yeah. And so, and offer to the fans. So it definitely, all these different like, genres like splitting off and all, it just, it helped me out as a promoter to be able to, you know, I don't want to do the same artist over and over. I mean, I want to bring new people.
Yeah.
And I want to keep changing it up. And so those new genres becoming popular or people becoming interested in it helped open a lot of doors. And now I'm doing, you know, going from a stage, a main stage and a local stage to a main stage, a drum and bass stage, a local stage to a main stage, a house stage, a drum and bass stage and a local stage. So, you know, it's just expanding out what we could do. And so it was, it definitely kept it interesting and definitely kept people coming.
Yeah, totally. When in the 90s was it when you realized like this is what I have to do full time?
Well, there was definitely some starts and stops.
Yeah.
I think, I mean, I don't have the exact I know at some point, well, I quit waiting tables, after, you know, maybe about 6 to 8 months of doing events because, I was on call and I had a big show and, I got called in. I was like, I'm not coming. You know, so that was the end of that. I think I hit a rough patch. Actually ended up going back to waiting tables at the same place and then had to quit again. I mean, I remember telling my mom, I think it was when I was quitting the CPA firm. And I was basically like, hey, I don't think I want to be an accountant, you know, I'm sorry. And it's just kind of like the same time I'm like telling my fiance that I don't want to be married. I had taken her to a party and it didn't go very well. She didn't enjoy it as much as I did. she's like, what the hell's going on here? So I was like, oh, you know, so I had to like, really, I had to make some life decisions. It was painful for everyone, but, this wasn't something that, you know, that in the end, it was the best thing that ever happened to her.
Yeah, totally.
So yeah, she would have been miserable. So, So, I mean, I came to the realization, it's like, hey, I'm going to make a run at this. I mean, I didn't think I'd be doing it for 30 years. Mm. That's for sure. But, I definitely thought I could do it and do it well and make a, you know, put a roof over my head.
Mm. I think for me in this industry, promoting, I've done it before and it's literally the hardest thing in this industry, in my personal opinion, because there's so many options for everybody to go and do on a Friday, Saturday, Thursday, whatever night of the week. There's so many options for people to have and to go and do, and getting people to a show is fucking impossible sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's not an easy thing to do. I mean, right. There's a lot of, and now, I mean, it's a lot different from when it was then. Right. Yeah. So I would have like $500 on the line or something. And so, you know, the numbers are so big now.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to really, you know, my sons have, asked about, they were like, oh, I want to do what you do. And I'm like, no, you don't want this. You don't want this life.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to really be able to, you have to, really be able to like disconnect from reality. And just hope everything goes okay. You know, just so it's like, you know, imagine waking up every morning and, you know, you have $20 million in shows.
Yeah.
And like in the next 6 months, I mean, it's sometimes, if you really think about it, if you really, like, if you're a smart person and really thought about it, you would be, yeah, it would drive you crazy.
Of course.
So yes, you have to like basically be able to, you know, have workarounds and be like, it's going to, you know, it'll work out. You do this, you got this. And so, you know, it's not a normal life, and it's not for like a normal person. Let's put it that way.
No, because
I wouldn't recommend it.
Cause I can imagine that, like, what's like, I know as an art, like as an artist, as a DJ producer, like the stress, the mental stress we put on ourselves for us as an artist, without sounding flappy dappy, like, is, I can't even imagine sometimes the stress that you guys go through to, like, how do you even deal with that? Is it something that gets better over years or easier?
No, it doesn't. It gets worse, because when I was young, I didn't really understand. Like, I was doing shows in warehouses with, you know, with no permits and, you know, selling alcohol to minors and no security guards and no insurance. And so
the good old days.
You know, the really disconnected days. So,
yeah.
I mean, but at the time, it didn't really, you know, I was young, right? So now, and I didn't really have anything to lose.
Yeah.
You know, now I have a family. I have a house, you know, it's definitely a different, you know, and you're risking on any weekend of a festival or something like that, you know, you're risking it all.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it hasn't become easier, because I've become wiser.
Mm.
And so, you know, you try to do the best you can to protect yourself from like, from the downsides. But you know, there's always a fact that there's something that could happen that's kind of beyond anyone's control, or it's something that maybe, you didn't think of, and you could be left holding a $10 million bill.
Yeah.
And then, you know, what do you do? So you have to think about, you always think about all the positives, like, oh, we're going to sell out and we're going to, this is what we're going to make. And, but you also have to be, you know, smart about it and think about what could happen if it all went bad.
Have you ever been in a situation, or how many, can you give us an example for a situation where it's like gone, shit's hit the fan? Cause it's definitely happened over the years, unless you're the,
I mean, we've had like, I mean, when there's been multiple times, I'm trying to think when's the most recent one. I mean, you know, we had a weather cancellation, in, it was 2022.
Yeah.
It was like, basically it was one day cancellation. We got the Saturday in, the Sunday, you know, that like the Sunday was supposed to be like a tornado and, you know, hail and, you know, all life threatening weather. And, you know, you just, so, and then you have me, all of a sudden me, who didn't have, you know, I'm asking like the fire, the police chief, the fire marshal, what do you got? What should I do? I'm asking my team. They're all like, well, I don't know. You know, like, you know, nobody wants to be on the hook.
Of course.
Right?
Of course.
Nobody. So, and so now, you know, the decision bounces back to me,
the boss,
the
yeah.
guy, the guy that did shows in warehouses with, you know, with nothing. So, I mean, I'm like, wait, I didn't sign up for this part, right? Why am I don't want to be the responsible one.
Yeah.
So yeah. So I pushed it as long as we could go. And then, you know, I called like a meeting. It was like 14 people, all the city officials and everything, and went around, asked everybody's opinion. I'm just getting a bunch of like non-answers.
Of course.
And, you know, and so, you know, now the clock's ticking, people are, the security guards are showing up. And so, you know, now I have to like make the call. So it basically was like, let's call the National Weather Service, right? So I, the head of safety or whatever calls the lady at the National, we hired them for the weekend, right? Yeah. And so he calls her and she's like, oh, you know, it's going to be a disaster. The storm's going to blow through. It's going to knock everything down. So right there, that was the answer, right? Because all these people, all these city officials and all heard that on the call. They would have been the witnesses at my at my trial, you know. So yeah, that was the answer. And so, you know, you have to, so we canceled that day, and of course, you know, the storm blew through, but the major part, we would have had to probably do a couple of evacuations. But as kids, you know, they don't see that, right? They just saw that it wasn't like that bad. So yeah, you know, you take a lot of shit online.
Yeah.
And then you have to refund everyone.
Yeah.
Which is a whole process, and we need to send out thousands of checks, and you know, people are moving all over. I mean, we still haven't been able to give everybody their money back.
Yeah.
Because it's a mess. And then it was because it was a partial refund.
Yeah.
So if you were on a payment plan, we needed to send you a check. And then I don't know, people, I know we have cancellation insurance. So people think, oh, you made your money back. But, you know, they don't pay you for like 8 months.
Yeah.
So I have to refund everybody like $2 million. I have to pay all the vendors, all their money.
Of course.
And then I have to fight with the insurance company for 8 months.
Yeah.
And then they don't give you the $2 million. They deduct what your $200,000 in insurance. They deduct your deductible.
Yeah.
So in the end, you end up working like 10 times as hard and you still lose like $500,000 or $600,000. I mean, yeah. It's just like it's kind of a buzzkill and everybody's mad at you.
Yeah. And I guess the thing that I want to kind of ask is, when you do that festival again, or when you do that show again, is it harder to sell tickets because of the previous experience?
Yeah, that's a whole nother, you know, you lose goodwill with people. They're like, oh, you know, it always gets canceled. And, or, you know, it's, why are you doing it this time of year? It's rainy season. So yeah, it's definitely, it hurts the brand for sure. Because people travel from everywhere, right?
And
you can't give them, you can't reimburse their hotel, and you can't ever give them that back. And they're, oh, I got my new outfit. And, so yeah, if you were trying to reimburse people for that, you know, the bill would be another $1 million.
Yeah. 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 It's crazy. It's crazy. I couldn't even imagine the stress. I remember when I played Dirty Bird East Coast, this was years ago, I think it was 2017, and they hadn't pulled any permits for the venue, and I turned up on the Saturday, and obviously we were all like super close friends, so you're in the office and you're just like, this is an absolute shit show, Like, and then they have weather issues, and you're just like, I couldn't even imagine what is. And that was on a very small scale festival. So like, to think what you guys do on a weekly basis is just, it's crazy to me. And the amount of people involved that kind of rely on your decision. And yeah, like, it's, that is insane amounts of stress. All we have to worry about as artists is don't push the wrong button. That's literally all we have to worry about.
I wanna go, if I could go back in time, I would have been a DJ. I would have been at the beginning, the promoter made all the money. And that's when I was like, oh, look, I'm the smart one.
Yeah.
And now I still, now I still make the same amount of money that I did in 94. But now I pay the DJ 1,000 times more.
Yeah.
So I should have, I just made a poor choice.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I want to go back a little further, and you have scaled Disco Donny Presents on another level. You're hands down one of the biggest electronic promoters in America.
Unfortunately. should have picked another genre too.
Yeah. Do you do anything outside of electronic?
I've dabbled in some stuff, you know. You know, when I first got into the rave scene, there was a lot of hip hop. So, I mean, we did a lot of like old school hip hop because we were like, the two scenes were like kindred spirits.
Yeah.
So we did a lot of that at our shows. I've done some other stuff, but it just, it never felt really genuine.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't want to be like the, like, going up to doing a country show and like, it just didn't feel like, so we're kind of branching out into other genres now just because, it just makes sense. And I'm kind of over that, like the authenticity part. Sorry. Mm-hmm.
Time to make some money.
Like, I mean, I have a team that we can do whatever, right? Yeah. So I can't let my, like, we do good events. So
exactly.
Why not like delve into other things and let that whole ego part go where it's like, well, I don't feel comfortable, faking this. But I mean, in the end, it's like, it's about the artist and it's not about me. It's about, the show and the artist. So
it's also about the experience, isn't it, for the ticket buyer. And if you can if you can create a really amazing experiences for the person that's going to the show and for the artist that's playing the show, it's like,
can do that. So I had to I always had like a wall about those type of things. So I was like, I don't wanna I always like thought it was kind of weird, like these promoters doing all this different genres and stuff, but I can see it now. We're working on a rock festival in Dallas, an emo fest.
Yeah.
In Dallas. It's been really interesting. My team's excited about it.
Yeah.
Because they grew up on all of that.
Yeah.
And so again, I had to remove my ego from the equation and go where, and look at the different business opportunities.
Yeah, totally. I get that. I want to go back to from when you go from promoting full time and then scaling that to where you're at now. How the hell do you even get there?
Well, I was doing like in the 90s, I was doing, I had started doing stuff around the South.
Yeah.
Like people started reaching out. It was a little bit different back then because you couldn't really, everybody had their promoters in their cities and they were all in a death match, right? They were all fighting with each other and over dates and artists and stuff like that. So in 97, 98, I started doing stuff in Texas. My first show in Austin was in 96. I was doing stuff in Atlanta, stuff in Houston, stuff in Dallas, but you couldn't really, at the time, it would have been a detrimental to put my logo was for what everybody thought, my logo on a flyer in another city, because it just would have been like, it was just so tribal. Like it was like the mob, right? Everybody had their families and they they were all at war with each other. So if you add somebody else into the mix, it just made everybody like hypersensitive.
Yeah.
So I was backing different people in different cities. So I had these relationships. And then when, I guess when the whole market crashed in like 2001, like
yeah.
it was on a downward turn. Like it had become too big.
Yeah.
Right. So it had become so big, and it was basically, it was like the cool thing to do. And then once all these people started coming in, all the cool people left.
Yeah.
So then, you know, it kind of, so without like the, you know, and again, this is free internet. Internet's the baby. Yeah. And so, you know, people just, there was no backbone to it. There was no, people didn't really know the artist. It just imploded on itself.
Yeah.
Because it, you know, it wasn't based on, it was like a scene. Mm-hmm. It wasn't based on, it was just based on, oh, this is the cool thing to do. It wasn't based on like the music or anything like that. So, and then we had the legal problems, and, you know, getting venues, and then 9/11 happened.
Yeah.
And that's when, you know, and at the same time, like hip hop was exploding.
Massive. Yeah.
Right. So all these things came together. It was like a perfect storm. And, you know, when we came out of it, like, you know, the rave scene was like cut in half.
Yeah.
Like it, you know, people, it was like a totally different world. So, you know, that's when I started going around. So people stopped doing shows. I mean, they just didn't make any financial sense to do them. So I started going around to all the old promoters in the different markets, and we're like, hey, you know, let's do shows. We'll do cheap tickets. We'll gather the people's email addresses. And when this thing comes back, then, you know, we'll be in the perfect position. Yeah. So I was able to kind of end up partnering up with a lot of people that already had been doing shows in the past, but just weren't doing anything anymore. Mm. And that's kind of how I spread around. At the, you know, there wasn't a lot going on. So the agents were looking for like connector dates, right? So I could do like Thursday in Austin, Friday in Houston, Saturday in Dallas, you know, so it was real easy for the agent just to contact me,
yeah,
send me a week. I've got Benny Benassi or whatever. I've got, you know, so, oh, we'll do a Midwest run. I'll do Cleveland, Nashville, Columbus. And then the next weekend we'll do a Texas run. So yeah, it just, that's kind of how I built out the company at the time. And, you know, I got everywhere from New York to Miami, to, you know, Seattle, to LA, you know, so, I mean, it was working. I was just really bad at contracts.
What made you say that?
Because I had a lot of partners. I've had a lot of partners, and yeah, they haven't all ended very well. So
that's the joys of business though, right? When money,
yeah, you know, I'm not going to change. So yeah. I'm still bad at contracts. So, so that's on them. That's on them. That's not on me.
So you kind of, one of the reasons why electronic music grew back into the States after the crash, right? You kept the scene going.
I mean, look, there was a lot of people. I don't want to like, I'm not taking credit for anything, but I was there. And I wasn't stopping, and it was rough. It was some very lean years. My wife was doing a residency. You know, we were having our second kid.
Yeah.
You know, I can't, you know, I have like very little money coming in. I'm still doing shows all over the place, but, you know, it's not really, I wouldn't say it's financially successful.
Yeah.
You know, I can't get any credit cards. I'm at the gas station trying to put gas in the car, and, you know, I can't, all of my mask out. You know, you have to borrow your wife's credit card, and
yeah,
Yeah, it's not like a, it wasn't a good feeling. It was a lot of lean times and a lot of like times where I had to, you know, really think like, you know, can I do this?
Yeah.
You know? So, and there was a lot of people that I worked with that just tapped out and just said, I can't do this anymore. You know, I'm going to go get a job. I'm like, this is a job. We got jobs. Nobody thinks it's a job, but we got jobs. But yeah.
Well, I think the thing is when you love doing something that you do, like you will literally just go until it ends to keep going.
No, I mean,
right.
No. Yeah. I mean, I loved it. And you know, it definitely kept me going through the bad times. I mean, I knew it would come back. I didn't know it would. I never knew it would get as big as it did.
Yeah.
I mean, in an imaginary world, I guess we could say, oh, I knew that, but I don't think anybody did. No. So, you know, when it started bubbling up again, like, I mean, you know, I'm talking about from 2001 to 2007, 2008. I mean, that's a long time to be paddling, doing a doggy paddle, you know, hoping that you can get to the end to find the island, right? When 2007, 2008 started hitting and people started using, you know, dance, you know, started using electronic music and the hip hop songs and Lady Gaga and stuff like that. And now they're playing like dance music on the radio again. So it just really, yeah.
The EDM days saved American
something
dancing.
Something like that. Yeah.
It's really interesting.
Daft Punk playing at Coachella saved the world.
Yeah. Was that a huge thing for you guys? Cause it was different in the UK. Like when I'm obviously from the UK, but like, growing up in the UK, electronic music scene has always been there ever since the 90s and never really.
Yeah, I mean,
away.
Look, when you're in the UK, you know, you're born with that, right? Yeah. So when you walk into a McDonald's in Europe, they're playing house music.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's that in the United States, and so people are like, grow up and that's their life. That's their lifestyle.
Really? Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
they don't wander far from that.
Nope.
And so, but in the States, you know, we change our musical taste like we change our underwear, right? So everybody just, oh, every 5 years now, you know, now I'm line dancing. Oh, now I'm hip hop, you know.
So
we don't have we're not very good at commitment. Let's just put it that way. So it definitely, but it just, you also know that it's going to cycle back and cycle back and cycle back. So when you have downturns, you know, you go back to the bottom of the barrel and then eventually you'll come back up to the top. Mm. So that's kind of what we were waiting for. But yeah, that Daft Punk thing, I think it was like where.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I think that people could finally just put in the visualization with the music and having all those tastemakers there and where they were like, oh, like now I get it now. Right. So, because before it was like, oh, it all sounds the same. It's just, you know, bleeps and blips and blah, blah, blah. But when you, when those people saw the show with the music, then they're like, oh, no, now this makes sense, yeah. Right? I mean, it's not just the music. It's everything that goes with it. And, you know, that's when I think Kanye started, you know, sampled them. And, you know, that's when people started, like, taking notice again.
Yeah, totally. That makes sense. What was your first ever festival of you actually running?
My first ever festival? Wow. I did a outdoor festival. Well, our big shows were like in a theater, right? So we would call them festivals per se. They could be like five stages or whatever, but
that's a festival.
That's like a little, now it is, but that was at a venue. The first time I did something, it was at a college, it was like 98. I was working with my partner was the owner of the venue of a theater that I worked with. So thank God he was there because, I had no clue what I was doing, and would have been, it would have been an epic, disaster. Like, I don't even think I ordered, I think the sound guy got, we'll be doing load in the stage. And the guy's like, where's the fence? And I'm like, fence? He's like, yeah, you need a fence. I was like, oh yeah. So, this is kind of, a little kid trying to do a big show. And we had like 8,000 people.
Wow.
It was two stages. It went till 7 a.m.
How do you even sell? How do you even sell 8,000 tickets?
I don't know. It was. At the time, 8,000 then was like, it was like 20,000-30,000.
Yeah.
Like 2 years later. So, and if we could have been able to, it was great. The show was great. There was no issues. Just the college wouldn't let us do it again. I guess they had some issues, but if we would have been able to do it the next year, it would have been 20,000 people, and it would have been better because, I learned. And then my first LA experience was I partnered with Pasquale and we did like Nocturnal in 99. And that was like my first, basically we had sold like 8,000 pre-sales and literally like 20,000 people showed up.
No way.
Trying to get in the gates and, we were just unprepared. So it was, it was creating like the venue had a show there the week before and I think they had like 3,000 or 4,000 people. So I think that's kind of what they were expecting. And we kind of blew that out of the water. Mm. And so the people were, tearing down the gates. And I don't know if you ever, LA is like a whole different animal.
Yeah.
Like the energy there is crazy. Like, so people were like, there was metal fences. It's at the National Orange Show where they still do shows. And so they would go through fences and they break down a section and everybody would just run in and then security would run over there and put the fence back up. And then they break down another section. So they, I think we ended up getting about 8,000 people in, but they had the police helicopters and everything. And they ended up tear gassing, like the gate, it was crazy.
That's wild.
Groove Ride. I remember all these Groove Rider got tear gassed, and all these artists coming in with like, I don't want to do shows in LA.
No.
So I've had some rough experiences, but you learn from them, right?
Yeah, it's the whole fun of it, and I think at the time, it's all super stressful when it happens, but then a few months later, you can laugh about it. And then a few years later, it's the best story ever.
I'm laughing about it now, I guess. Yeah, so exactly. I had to stay in LA. I had to stay in LA and for like 2 or 3 weeks just to refund like the people that didn't get in. So it was crazy.
That's mad.
Yeah.
Do you still partner with Pasquale at all?
No. I think that our business relationship ended like in 2012.
Yeah.
So we still chat.
Still on good terms though.
Yeah, I am. You have to ask him.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. That makes sense. It must be interesting. I want to kind of breach over that relationship though, because both of you guys have done amazing things in the electronic scene, and it feels like from the outside, and obviously it might not be like this on the inside, but it feels like that there isn't. I know there's competition between every promoter in the world. There's competition between every artist in the world. However, I'm a firm believer that there's space for everybody at some point, somewhere. And it really feels like you have your space and Insomniac has their space. And together you guys are creating something really interesting for American electronic music, which it doesn't really happen elsewhere.
Yeah, no, I mean, like I was a part of that for whatever, 12, 13 years, and brought, you know, EDC to Orlando and New York and, you know, the Beyond Wonderland to Seattle and EDC to Puerto Rico. And so, yeah, I was a part of that. And, you know, now they're doing their thing. I mean, what they do is, you know, to be there from like the ground floor. I mean, we were doing, 10,000 people for EDC in LA. I mean, in San Bernardino, like in 2012, 2013 was like 10,000 people. 2014 was like 10. So, you know, it wasn't an overnight success. So to be there for that and see that, and what it's become, like EDC Vegas is like crazy. Yeah. Like it's a real, it's like Disney World, right? Yeah. So, yeah, they do their own thing. I mean, I do mine. So, we don't cross paths that often. I mean, sometimes we're button heads a little places in some markets, but, you know, that's to be expected. But yeah, I mean, we've talked about it. He's happy. Pasquale's happy. He's successful. I'm happy. I'm semi-successful. So, maybe it's like a friendly competition or whatever. I mean, not trying to kill each other or anything. So that's good.
It's nice to hear though that as well, because I think there's so much, there could be so much animosity between.
Animosity, right. That was the word I couldn't say earlier, right?
With regards to your team, like obviously you have a big team around you, but how have you kind of like situated your team around you? Because you can't do everything. You physically can't. I'm sure you have a lot of stays, how is that built over the years, and who are those people?
Well, true. I can't do everything. I used to try to do everything. Yeah. And that was the hardest part, was basically, and this is probably the hardest part for anybody that has their own company, is to be able to let go of something. Right. So, I hung on to like doing the bookings for too long and the settlements and just everything that I was trying to do, just because I didn't want to lose I didn't want to lose the contact with the agents. But you know, in the end, when I was able to finally start relinquishing, why do we keep using these words we can't say?
We clearly didn't go to school properly.
I really should have go back. Yeah. So basically, I'm trying to use big words, but I don't know how to even use them, right? So I know what they mean. I just can't say them.
Yeah.
I guess I get half credit for that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, but when I started giving up stuff and I was like, oh, this is amazing. I started, I was like, oh, you know, I had more time for myself. I'm not talking. I mean, I literally had a cell phone, a house phone, and an office phone, and I would have three calls coming at the same time from like the same agency. Like, you know, when I first started, there was like one agent, and then there was like, oh, there was like three or four agents, but they had like an assistant, or maybe they didn't have anybody.
Yeah.
And it was one of me and one of them, four agents, right? So that wasn't that bad. Now, all of a sudden, those agents have 20 agents under them.
Yeah.
And they're, you know, so I have from the same company, three different agents calling me at the same time, because they didn't have anybody else to call.
Yeah.
There was nobody else doing shows. Mm. So, you know, they're calling me. So I learned, like, once I gave up the bookings, I was like, oh, this feels good. This is how it should be. And so I started, you know, so I've had my core team. A lot of them have been with me for like over 10 years. I mean, most, we've been really good at retaining people. I mean, we've lost a few good ones, and, you know, it's natural. I've never like try to hold anybody back. Right. So if somebody wants to move on and they have a better opportunity, and that's what they want to do, you know, I'll write the recommendation for them.
Yeah.
I just, you know, I don't want them to come try to hurt me.
Yeah.
But yeah, it happens. I mean, we have like, we're not a huge team. Maybe I have like 16, 17, like full part-time people. And I mean, most everybody's full-time, maybe a couple of part-time people. And then, I mean, you know, obviously when we're doing a festival or something, that we're bringing on another 1,000 people.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, we've been lucky to keep the same core group together for a long time.
Yeah.
Everybody knows each other. Everybody knows like, oh, you know, he's just coming back from a festival. He's going to be grumpy today, or, you know, whatever. It happens. Right. Yeah. So then I'm talking about me.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm still tired from last week's trip. So.
I can imagine. Do you go to every festival?
Yeah. I mean, all the big stuff, I'm at for sure. Yeah. I mean, I don't go to as many of the club events as I used to. Yeah. Just because
it's not worth it.
I mean, it's my recovery time's a lot more.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then somebody might give me drugs or something like that. I might get dosed. Makes sense. Somebody dosed me with some cocaine and now I'm grumpy.
What a shame.
Yeah. Now I want some.
I read online that you guys do over 1,000 shows a year.
Yeah.
How?
I think it was like, yeah, we were over 1,000, probably going into COVID. I think we're like at 800 now. So we might need to like modify that one. It sounds so much better than 800, but yeah.
Yeah. But like even 800, but like 1,000 shows is like 2.5 shows a day.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely some 100 show weekends, like, you know, Halloween weekend or something. Yeah. It gets kind of crazy. And there's like some weekends where there's like 10 shows or something. So, you know, it's difficult because a lot of these venues they only have 52 Fridays and 52 Saturdays. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they want content all the time. And we're like, oh, you know, our job is like to try to keep them in business.
Yeah.
So, you know, and not all of them are going to be winners. So we have different deal structures set up where, you know, we're protected on some of these, cause you know, I don't want to just do shows.
Not worth it.
But you know, it's a good way to be able to, develop talent, bring in new people and stuff and see how it goes.
Well, it's also really interesting. You're developing cities as well, which that are cities that you wouldn't think have electronic music in.
Yeah, that's been all when I first started going around the country, I was kind of, I basically based it on where people, I wasn't going in where people were, right?
Yeah.
So I wasn't going in uninvited. So, you know, I was going where, you know, that stuff wasn't happening. So, you know, if you go into a New York or an LA or something like that, you know, you better bring the big guns.
Exactly.
You know, you're going to be fighting against
everybody
10, else. 15, yeah. 20 promoters, and they're not going to be, they're not going to be happy, and they're not going to play fair. They're not going to play nice.
Yeah.
So, and you're going to work, you know, I've had many opportunities to, I've had many offers to go into LA, since I, you know, since I stopped working with Insomniac, and I'm just like, I mean, what do you, it's just, I would have to work 20 times as hard,
yeah,
you know, to produce, you know, same effort as if I could just go do a show in like Nashville, Tennessee.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, why am I going to, why am I going to beat my head against the wall,
yeah,
for, and, you know, upset the apple cart, turn over the apple cart just, yeah, to prove a point. So yeah, I mean, I've managed to just try to stay away from all those bigger markets.
No, I think it's really interesting what you've done, and it makes complete sense as well. There's a lot of space in America, a lot of places, yeah, a lot of cities. It's a big old
country.
There you go. It's a big old country.
The only smart thing I've ever done or said
So talking about things you said,
oh God,
here we go.
What'd I say?
Here we go. I saw a tweet.
That wasn't me.
I saw a tweet and it said, I forgive you.
I got hacked.
It said, I forgive you, Joe Biden.
Oh, did I say that?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I've been told a brief story about your relationship between you and Joe Biden over the years. And I kind of want, I don't know the full story. So I want to get to know what is this?
Well, yeah. So I guess in or around like 99, 2000, the DEA, opened up a case on me and the theater I was working at. And so they followed me. I mean, like I was under surveillance for like 8 months.
That's crazy.
So they went to a bunch of my shows. Well, I always thought they were, but I was like super paranoid at the time, right? Who knows what drugs I was on. So, but yeah, it's like, oh, I was like the guy in Goodfellas, right? The helicopters, yeah, follow me and shit. I mean, yeah, I was like the Henry Hill character. So I was like, my phone was tapped. I mean, so.
Was it really?
Anyway, no, I mean, it was. I mean, I don't think it was legally tapped. Yeah. I don't know if they got the court order for that.
Yeah.
But I, you know, definitely sounded like it was tapped. Or I always thought it was, right? So we were joking around like, hey, come, you know, pick up the stash or whatever. It's like, because you could hear the people, it was like clicking the whole time. Like,
yeah,
somebody was on the line. Like,
yeah,
like, hey, we can hear you. But you know, I didn't know. No.
Yeah.
And, but yeah, I mean, they had like, you know, when they finally arrested me or whatever, they, so what happened? I'm jumping right to the end.
Yeah.
That's how I do. That's how I tell stories. I'm amazing. I'm just the clip notes. So basically, yeah, they were attending, our shows, and they were making drug purchases.
Yeah.
And then they, instead of like, and we knew they were in there, right? Because we let them in.
Yeah.
Like so we knew they were there. So we thought we were cooperating, and but they weren't going after the drug dealers. They were going after us. So they, like, instead of arresting the person they bought the drugs from and trying to find out where that guy got the drugs from, they were like just putting it in my bag, right? Like, oh, this is another, you know, here's another 10 pills for Donnie, you know? Yeah. So they were just like, like adding it up. And I'm like, oh shit. You know, so I don't know this is going on. And so, yeah, they raid it was like August of 2000. And like the scene is like, this is like, it's blowing up.
Yeah.
This is like the best time. This is way beyond our, we're just like 5,000-6,000 people every month. Yeah. Right. And I've got a venue inside the theater that we're doing weeklies, drum and bass weeklies, 1,000 people every week. Just like everything's off the chains. And we have a show, it's like 4,000 sold in advance. So we're probably gonna do 5,000 or 6,000 people. And the DEA raids the place, but not during the show. They raid it like 2 or 3 hours before doors. Mm. So, you know, I wasn't even there yet. Cause now by this time I'm like, I'm the highfalutin promoter and I just show up at the end, you know, and just take all the credit. that hasn't changed. So, yeah. So basically, yeah, the venue owner called me. He's like, Donnie, don't come down here. We've been raided, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, for what? And he's like, I don't know. They're like, basically, you know, they were searching through all the sound equipment, all the turntables. They were opening everything up. You know, they had this theory that we were bringing the drugs in before the show, and then we were selling them from backstage to the people, right? So in their minds, the drug dealers were working for us,
yeah.
Right? So when they were buying those drugs, they thought that, and that's kind of how they sold it come to find out they had gone in front of Congress and got funds to run this whole operation. And, you know, and this is how they got the search warrants and all that stuff, right? That they had this theory.
Yeah.
And that, you know, I had run the drug dealers and they had VIP passes and they would go back and forth. And there probably was drug dealers going back and forth backstage, but they weren't working for me.
Yeah.
So, you know, they had parts of the story and then they made up into this whole like fantasy world that I was selling the drugs.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, they ended up searching everybody and, you know, tearing everything up. And basically they found like one joint on a bartender. They're like, oh shit. So, at the same time, I've arrived. I've flushed all the drugs at my house down the toilet. So in case they were going there, and then I'm underneath the venue and I'm at a restaurant that's connected to the theater, but on the side of it, and I'm directing all my team to basically, tell people in line that we're going to open tonight. And so like, you know, some people left or whatever, but there's still like a huge crowd. And eventually the DA gets worn down. They're like, oh, it's nap time, right? It's like 11 or 11:30. So they leave. They actually walk in into the restaurant I'm at. And then I, like, as they're ordering, I like sneak out through the door. So I was like, I wish we had a photo of that one. I mean, I could draw you one, but anyway. So it was pretty amazing. And we opened the fucking doors and we had the party and they were pissed that we did the show. And they said, you know, basically come get a lawyer and, you know, we'll talk to you on Monday.
Yeah.
So yeah, on Monday we went in and they, you know, we went and met with the lawyer and we're like, what is, you know, cause I mean, everybody thought it was taxes or something because we definitely had tax issues. I've cleared those up. I've cleared it up right away. But at the time, I'd had tax issues. I mean, that's what I thought. And then the guy's like, I remember the venue owner had his wife and in there, and we're just like, what is it? You know, what could it be? And they're like, well, you're getting charged with the crack house law. And we're like, what? Yeah. The crack house. Like, what's that? Oh, well, what's the time on that? Well, it's 0 to 20. Whoa. Oh, okay. Yeah. How many drug, Like, how do you get the years? Oh, well, it depends on how many drugs they bought. I'm like, well, how much did they buy? 18 years worth. I'm like, oh, shit. So like the guy's wife's crying. People are like falling on the floor. It's like a Baptist church revival. Yeah. People are like, you know, convulsing everywhere and stuff. And, and then he's like, well, that's not the bad one. That's the good one. I'm like, okay. So he's like, and you're getting charged with a continuing criminal enterprise, a CCE, which is what they use to break up the mob, right? So basically you're doing something illegal multiple times. And they're like, well, what's that? They're like, 20 to life. It's like, life? Yeah. So, you know, and here's like 20 something year old me, right? And I'm like, huh, you know, it's like, it was crazy, like, to have that be dropped on my head. And I still never knew the gravity of it all. Because I still kept on, I had shows scheduled that was supposed to be at the theater, and I thought they were like chasing that venue, but they were actually chasing me. So I moved the show, I moved a couple of shows, and they harassed everybody there, and I moved another one, and they shut it down. So, I just started doing, shows like at House of Blues, which is like a Live Nation venue.
Yeah.
I started doing a weekly there. So I never stopped doing shows, but I just didn't really understand, I don't think, like, really what I was, like, getting myself into.
How did it stop?
Well, I had to turn myself in, and, you know, I had a bunch of meetings with them, and they were, basically telling me how, you know, bad of a person I was and all this other stuff. And I could tell that, like, they didn't really get it. What am I supposed to do? My lawyer at the time you understand, this is 2000, right? Yeah. This is think of how much the world has changed the last 20 years.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, I don't know what people are going to think about this. I know people are like, when the government's saying that, ruining people's kids' lives and, people are going to listen, right? They're like, we win. I don't know if you know how the justice system works, but they're like, it was a federal case. And they're like, we're going to bring in 100 agents from DC. This is this is a priority for us. This is a test case for them, right? Because they wanted to stamp out raves everywhere.
Yeah.
So, we're going to bring in all these agents. We're going to arrest you on TV at 6 a.m. at your mom's house. We're going to, this is going to be all over the news. You know, this is going to be bad. We win 99.999% of our federal cases, that's like a true number.
Yeah.
Like they win these cases. So it's like, wow, that's a pretty good, so what's my chance? So you're saying there's a chance for me. I get like 0.0001% chance I could possibly get out of this. So, they were all, you know, so my lawyer's like, you got to talk to them, see what they offer you. Right. And so, they were offering me like a year. Like, they just wanted this case. They just wanted this, like, this precedent set. Right. Mm-hmm. So then they could just go around and hit everybody over the head with it. And so that's how like law in the United States works. Right. Yeah. If somebody sets this up once, then basically like, oh, look, it worked here. And the other judge is like, well, yeah, that's fine. I mean, we got to go with that, whatever that guy made the decision. So they're off me a year, like, and they're like, oh, you know, you can get out in 6 months and then go to the halfway house for 6 months. And I'm like, you know, you have to think about it when you have a year versus like life.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's like, oh, you know, what's the possible chance? What if I get a bunch of like grannies in there in the courtroom on the jury, and you know, you don't know what judge you're going to get. You don't know where, like, the district you're going to have. What's the jury pool going to look like? So that's why they win a lot of these cases, because, you know, a lot of times people plead guilty.
Yeah.
So just went through the whole motion of it all. I got a new lawyer, and he was like, just keep telling them, keep talking to them, and keep saying you're going to, like, you're thinking about it. You're going to work with them until you go in front of that judge and say you're guilty. Then, it's nothing. You can say anything you want to them. Just don't. So they were pretty confident that we were going to plead guilty. So they went on to, like, they went on TV and did their big press conference about, like, what, and that's when everything changed.
Yeah.
Because, you can't, I don't know if you know about also in criminal cases, you can't really talk about it with anybody. So nobody really knew what was going on. Mm. And I couldn't really, if you tell somebody, you engage them in the case, right? Totally. So now they're, so now they've become a witness and they're involved, right? So who wants to bring this mess on to other people? And they had given immunity to everyone that worked at the venue. And they were, they were really coming after us. The thing is, I never sold any drugs. I wasn't like, I wasn't that smart.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sorry. I wasn't that stupid. I could have, I just did. No, I just, that wasn't what I was. Yeah. I was the promoter. I wasn't the drug dealer.
Yeah.
And everybody has their role.
Yeah.
And so I was doing mine I guess I was doing it too well. But and maybe they were doing theirs. They were doing their poor job of theirs. But I basically they went on TV and they said, sorry, I have these long run on sentences.
It's fine.
So sorry, people. So they basically went on TV and said, hey, we got this case. This is the worst case ever. And like the U.S. attorney said, it was the most unconscionable drug offense he's ever seen in his whole 30 years career.
Wow.
Meanwhile, he had like police selling cocaine and killing people and stuff. And this was worse than that. This was the worst one. Basically it was a big to do. They had all the photos, the ravers with the glow sticks and all, oh my God. And then it went like this, like right now it's like in a newspaper, people are writing letters in that, this is like a reach. It's on the talk radio. Like people are like, this is bullshit. Yeah. You're going to arrest all the promoters, for somebody smoking a joint at Jazz Fest. And so I was like, oh wait, I'm not crazy.
Yeah.
Like people do get this, that, I never thought I was guilty of anything. And I never thought I should plead guilty. But I just didn't know I don't know what other people thought. Right. And so when I got that, and then ACLU got involved, because now it's like people know. People thought I was doing something wrong.
Yeah.
And now they realize, like, oh, this is bullshit. And that's kind of when I had this wave of support, come up. And then I was able to be like, okay, now I can talk about this in general terms with people, right? And say, because this is all public knowledge. And then they're like, yeah, this is bullshit. And I'm like, yeah, it's bullshit. They're like, no, this is bullshit. I'm like, yeah, it's bullshit. I know. But when you be able to bounce that off of people, it definitely changed the narrative and how and what I was going to do. And, I remember, like, I was still doing shows the whole time. I was like, dumbass, little kid. By me doing these shows every weekend, it showed to them that, like, if they were going to put me in jail for doing shows, and then I came right back out of, I went to, I had to go turn myself in for one day, and I kept doing shows, but then they couldn't put me in jail for these other shows.
Yeah.
It was just like, it didn't make any sense. So, I just remember I was like, nope. I'm not taking the plea deal. I'm sorry. You guys, I understand, you're trying to do your job, but I'm just doing mine.
Yeah.
And, you got the wrong guy. And so, they were like threatening me, and they were like, we're going to get you one day and we'll see you soon. They were like, we see that file cabinet over there. That's all you. And I was like, I was like, oh geez. So There's a very large file cabinet somewhere with a lot about me. So hopefully they'll release it 50 years after my death.
Damn, that's a wild story. Anything to stop raves. And Joe Biden was all behind that, I take it.
Well, no. So I think the main thing was, his main thing was, after this, I'm not really sure who was like, you know, that was when Clinton was in office and stuff. So, but basically, you know, the main thing that on the Biden connection is, you know, a couple, like a year or two later, they tried to, when they realized they ran this crack house case on a club in Panama City that was like famous for, they would do MTV event, spring break,
yeah.
Club La Vila. And they actually went to trial with that one. And the jury came back in 5 minutes and said that they said, this is bullshit. So I was like, I told you. So basically that was the end of their kind of crack house, like dalliance, yeah. Where they were like, okay, this isn't going to work. So basically the next round of this was they tried to do the rave act.
Yeah.
And so, and that was the one where, you know, there's the videos of Joe Biden online and, you know, he's basically, you know, railing against rave promoters and saying you have to arrest the promoter. And, you know, this is where the rave act came through. And it was basically, it was attached to like an Amber Alert bill, which is like when Amber Alert is when a child gets kidnapped.
Yeah.
In the United States. And then, you know, they send out this alert to everyone, right? So who's going to vote against that, right? So this, Amber Alert and Rave Act together sounds like a fucking match made in heaven. And so it passed. But Biden was like one of the strongest, you know, I guess supporters of that. And his video is like pretty, it's pretty silly. But it's just interesting that he's the president now. So I think so just to wrap this one up. So the reason I was having, before the last election, you know, I was having people from both sides, like, asking me to come out and support one of the presidential candidates.
Of course.
And I live in Puerto Rico, so I can't even vote.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and who wants to listen to who wants to listen to me? Like, I'm a fucking rave promoter,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Nobody cares. Like, I don't want to influence anybody. I just want people to register. I just want people to vote.
Yeah.
So that was what I was concentrating on. But I forgive you, Joe Biden, just to put a bow on this giant, long 30-minute story. Was basically his daughter used to go to my events.
Oh, no right? way.
So, and I know she had issues with, you know, whatever things, like a lot of kids do, go through things, right? Experiment with things. So I always looked at it. I have kids, right? So I just looked at it as like basically he was projecting, like trying to protect his daughter. That's just how I rationalized it in my head.
Yeah, yeah.
Even though he was wrong, but I'm just trying to imagine where that came from and where that vitriol came from. And I'm assuming that it's possibly came from that place. And I, as a father, know that when my kid fucks up, I got to blame somebody else.
Of course.
Because I did a perfect job. It's not his fault and it's not my fault. So whose fault is it? It's the rave promoter's fault. So I think that's where that came from.
Yeah.
And end scene.
And the rave promoter is always easy. It's so easy to blame. Like, it's countless times. Like, Fabric in London got closed down for God knows how long because somebody died outside. And
right.
And it's like, I get it. It's an easy thing for the law system to blame somebody. And we're the people that they're going to blame.
Simple. Right. Well, I'm used to it. So
yeah, of course.
I'm here for it.
Dude, I can take it. We've just done an hour and a half.
Oh, shit.
And I'm sure we could keep talking. But
I'm sure people are going to be like, fuck this. I'm not watching this shit. Yeah. But dude, I think I blew through some calls already.
Sorry, man.
No, that's all right. It was fun.
I didn't know
it was that long. So
no, it was great. It was amazing. Thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, man.
Thanks for having me at your shows over the years. Thank you for all the support. And thank you for creating an amazing scene in America now. It's beautiful.
How long are we going to do the beard here? Because I've seen the photos of you pre-beard. I mean, you were like a supermodel.
Really? The thing is, I've got no hair now. Oh yeah, I see that.
That's a look though.
Yeah, I've got to kind of keep the. If I take this beard off, I still look like a 15-year-old. I look so young.
But I've tried, but once it gets like a little long, I just like it's hot in Puerto Rico too. So maybe I have multiple excuses here.
There's stages.
All right. Well,
I'll see you soon. Yes, mate. I'm sure I'll see you at a festival soon. Keep safe, keep doing what you're doing, and really appreciate it, man.
All right, thanks. All right, bye-bye.
Thank you, man. And that's a wrap. Hope you enjoyed it. Hope everybody liked the conversation. Big love to Donnie for coming on. Thank you to all that's listened. Please share it. Keep safe. See you next time.
Everybody in your crew identifies as either Big Mac Burger, McNuggets, or McCrispy Sandwich, but you're the Filet-O-Fish Sandwich all day. That crispy fish, that savory tartar sauce, that melty cheese, that pillowy bun. Yeah, you get it. Every time.
And if you love the Filet-O-Fish, right now you can catch two of the classics you love for just $6. Limited time only. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer. Single item at regular price.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.